is Hyperspace Theology, exploring what we can know about life and faith and God Almighty through a galaxy far, far away.
Welcome to Hyperspace Theology, a show in which we're exploring theology through the lens of a galaxy far, far away. From Jabba to Jonah, Darth to David, Boba to Boaz, the Star Wars galaxy is jam-packed with theological themes, and we're going to crack them wide open. Hopefully this can be of help to you in your journey of faith, or hey, at the very least, can enhance your appreciation for the galaxy we all know and love. I'm your host, Jared Mays. Join me once again this week from literally the opposite side of the country. I'm coming from Maine. He's coming to us from the shade of a palm tree in South Texas is Kevin Burr. How are you?
Guys, it's good to be here with y'all tonight. And the shade of a palm tree does not give much shade. I'll go ahead and tell you that right now.
It almost sounded like, what is it Jesus says to, it's one of the apostles, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree?
Yeah. Nathaniel, right? Yeah.
Okay. I remember I had a whole class in college where we did like a word study to try to find out what that meant. And 10 years later, I don't remember. So one of these days, I'll do another word study and we'll have the answer. But you know who else probably doesn't know the answer is Scott Howland. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing well, and I don't know the answer. So
I was like,
we're all on the same page.
I was hoping Scott was going to say, actually, I was studying this just last week.
It had something to do with wisdom. Anyway, you know what has nothing to do with wisdom? Tonight's topic, which is, of course, chosen this week by Kevin. Took me a second there. Chosen by Kevin. Kevin and I are both medicated for different reasons tonight, so it's going to be a fun episode for sure.
Yeah.
Kevin, what do you have in store for us this episode?
So this was a suggestion that you had given us a while ago, and I wanted to run with it a little bit because, as I mentioned in our very first episode, episode 00, I guess technically, I really enjoy anything Obi-Wan Kenobi. From just watching Ewan McGregor's performance to Sir Alec Guinness's performance to the memes, to the memes of Obi-Wan that you can find online. I'm an Obi-Wan fanboy, and I've mentioned too, part of it is because he is not perfect. He is very much not perfect. Right. But I can't think of anybody who would want to dismiss Obi-Wan's importance, you know. Like, Obi-Wan's very well respected in the fandom, and yeah. So anyway, when you had this suggestion on here and it was rooted in a quote from Obi-Wan, I thought, ooh, this is something that that I wanted to work with.
One big question for you. Is your Obi-Wan impression nearly as good as your Yoda impression?
Not at all. Not at all. The best I can do is, hello there.
That's more of like an Alec Guinness hello there.
That's the first time I've ever tried it. So, hello there. Yeah, you're getting it pretty new, pretty green. So take that for what it's worth. Maybe you can edit that out if you want to.
It was great. I loved it. The line that we're talking about is, right, you've just taken your first steps into a larger world, right? So we're talking about what it is to get started on your Christian journey. And thinking about that from the Star Wars point of view, it starts in, I like to distinguish like an Obi-Wan Kenobi versus a Ben Kenobi. For me, A New Hope Obi-Wan is Ben Kenobi. Do you feel the same way, old Ben?
That kind of makes sense. He's got a different mission in life. He's no longer. I think he's still very much capable, but his mission is no longer protect the Republic. It's to protect Luke. So,
or to cut your arm off in a bar if necessary.
And he'll do it and just kind of casually withdraw, and everybody else realizes, oh, all right, I'm not going to mess with that guy. I have no quarrel with you, sir.
What I love about it is it's almost like we're going to get off on a tangent here. When he cuts off, was it Ponda Baba's arm? When he does so, what it signals to me is like people have seen him do it before. They're like, oh yeah, that's old Ben. That's what he does. What do you think, Scott? Is that true? Do you think that's accurate?
Possibly. I don't know. It's tough to know whether. Hopefully, we'll find out with that new when the new Obi-Wan series comes out. It'll fill in a little bit of that time that he spent there. Because up until that point, it's just he's studying Jedi text and watching a little kid run around and, you know, stub his toe a lot. And trying to fly planes,
you know, if he cuts off some
rats and stuff.
If he cuts off an arm in this new Obi-Wan show, I will lose my mind. That'd be amazing.
Par for the course in Star Wars, anyway. See, the limbs and hands are flying all over the place.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. This episode's also all over the place. Kevin, get us back on the rails. Tell us about the topic.
All right. So, rolling again with Jared, some of your helpful suggestions here. Ben Kenobi leads the young, and it's fair to say naive, right? I mean, Yoda has a great comment on it. You know, in Empire, he says something like, you know, he craves adventure, he's reckless, in this kinds of things. But Ben Kenobi leads this young and naive Luke Skywalker away from the only home that he's ever known. Nothing that's truly inspiring, right? It's a moisture farm on a desert, and takes him to a place where Luke has been before at different times. But this great line, what exactly does he say? Wretched hive of scum and villainy. Yeah.
Also known as the church.
Oh.
No. Hopefully not.
But it takes them to Mos Eisley, basically to get them to Alderaan. And then, one thing leads to another. Han shoots first, and we have...
Yes, he does.
He does, yeah. And then there's this great moment. Luke is training with the lightsaber on the Millennium Falcon, and he slowly begins to sense... he slowly begins to open up to the Force. He's always been Force sensitive, but he's actually growing in that sensitivity to the Force and learning to stretch out and trust what he's feeling through the Force. He starts being able to block.
He's actually learning what it is.
Exactly.
He's probably had these Force feelings for a while, but he doesn't know. What is this? I don't know. Does everybody have this kind of thing? You know, so he's learning that, I'm unique.
Yeah.
Or more unique. The impression that Owen Lars is doing much in terms of like spiritual education on the homestead there on Tatooine. Like he's not telling Luke myths about the Force. It sounds like he's trying to suppress the Force.
Right.
In any kind of Jedi lore in the home. So yeah, he's not just learning how to use the Force. He's even learning what the Force is.
He is learning. Yeah. In that moment, he is learning that there is an entirely different world to the world that he thought he knew. And so after a couple of successful blocks, Ben Kenobi congratulates him and says, "You've taken your first step into a larger world." Jared, something that you pointed out is that, it kind of gave us this thought question. What would have happened if Luke had never progressed? What if he had
I wrote
just...
that question 7 years ago, so wow. I don't remember asking it. Yeah. I've been doing this podcast for a long time.
This podcast has been stewing for a long time.
I'm flabbergasted by the question. What would have happened if Luke had never progressed? If he'd never taken more than the first step, right? He takes the first step into the larger world in A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
But that could have been the end of the story, right?
I think so, yeah. And that's worth digging into for a little bit. I don't think it's hard to see that had Luke not continued on, I think it's fair to say that the first Death Star would not have met its fate, not at the hands of Luke Skywalker. Maybe at some point they would have gotten somebody in there, but maybe not. Maybe they needed someone with Luke's Force sensitivity after not having anybody like that, maybe they needed someone with Luke's force sensitivity to be able to shoot at the right time.
Don't be bad mouthing Wedge there.
That's Wedge, fair.
Could Wedge have done it? That's a good question. Now, the deal is they try to point out the fact that even the best of the pilots couldn't make that shot in A New Hope, right? Who is a rogue leader who ends up biting it after taking a good shot at the, what do you call it, the exhaust port on the Death Star.
Yeah.
He says, negative, negative, it didn't go in. And so it's like, oh, rogue leader, you know, you tried, man. And then he bites it. You know, Vader shoots him down. Mm-hmm. And I think the point there is you can't do this just with good piloting, right? You need force sensitivity.
Yeah.
Do you think Wedge would want to argue with me?
It even, like, if you look at the shot, it's got to take a turn.
Right.
It's not like it's a straight, you're hitting a button. It's got to take that turn. And maybe that's what the force part of it was. You know, when you know, Rogue Leader took his initial shot, it just impacted on the surface and it didn't actually turn down. So maybe that's kind of what they were talking
like
about.
Like in basketball, it rimmed out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He hit the back of the rim. And Luke picked up the rebound. You know, the big question, of course, is what would have happened if Luke had taken the first step but hadn't taken the second step, right? If he mm-hmm. hadn't continued his Jedi training. And there's actually a couple of different answers to this in the expanded universe. One, back in the 90s, there was this series of comics. We actually covered these on Legends Look Back in an episode called What If. We covered these comics from Dark Horse called Star Wars Infinities, I believe is what they're called. And they took each of the movies and made one tweak, one simple detail that if it hadn't gone the way that it did in the film, what would have the rest of the story, you know, how would the rest of the story have played out? Rogue Leader makes the shot. No. What is it? They blow up the Death Star. The Death Star is destroyed. The Rebels are not successful. The Death Star is destroyed, so then the Rebel Alliance is much more of a ragtag movement. So they do kind of explore Luke not becoming the kind of Jedi that he became in A New Hope, not having that next big successful leap into stardom, superstardom in the Star Wars galaxy. And then secondly, and I think more interestingly to the point of tonight's topic, in the novelization of The Last Jedi. Did you guys know that these existed? Like, authors will write a full-length novel of mm-hmm. the films, turning them into a book?
Sometimes I'm aware of them, sometimes I'm not. But like the only one I was really aware of was the one for The Last Jedi, not The Last Jedi, the Rise of Skywalker, because it explains all this stuff that the movie tried to cram in there and they couldn't.
Yeah, that's one of the better ones. I would say the novelization for Revenge of the Sith is one of the very best Star Wars books ever written. Mm-hmm. It's the only Star Wars book that I categorize as capital L literature. All right, it's a great book. Yeah. But then, it's totally worth your time by Matthew Stover. But the novelization for The Last Jedi, written by an author named Jason Fry, the most interesting thing in the book is he writes a prologue. He writes a prologue of Luke having a vision on Octu where the Force learns how to break in past his barrier that he puts up in order to try to call him back into the action. And he receives a vision. The prologue is Luke having a dream of him never having left Tatooine. Luke has a dream of being an old man married to Cammy, who you might know from like the deleted scenes of A New Hope. She was a character who, you know, didn't quite make the cut. His like childhood girlfriend. He's a moisture farmer. He has an unremarkable life. He stayed friends with his, like, you know, you would equivocate to his high school best friends. He never left the nest. And the galaxy was still under Imperial rule. They had like rations and quotas on how much food and water they were allowed every day. And it was kind of a restrictive life, but kind of a happy life for Luke because he was comfortable. And I think that is a really interesting exploration of what might have happened in the Star Wars galaxy mm-hmm. if he hadn't really followed that call to adventure. I think he would have lived a comfortable life, but the rest of the galaxy wouldn't have. Are you with me?
Yeah. Interesting that you put it too in terms of answer that call to adventure. The preaching minister at the church where I work at, has been doing a series on the Old Testament figure of Abraham. And he's basically been framing this as Abraham is kind of a late bloomer, that late in life, he answers this call to adventure. Here's a guy who is in his 70s or 80s, hasn't appeared to do anything significant with his life. He's got, you know, he's still living with his parents in his hometown, his home country. He's still under his father's household, ancient Near Eastern custom. And he gets called basically away from that to a land that he doesn't know, to, you know, to basically to be the father of this great nation that, you know, in hyperbolic terms is difficult to number. And it would have been like, what if Abraham hadn't gone all the way to this? What if at some point he had stopped and said, "Hey, you know, maybe I kind of like it down here in Egypt, and you know, yeah, maybe we don't need to. Maybe getting out of dad's house was good enough, and maybe we don't need to try to worry about all this,
sure,
all this kid stuff."
Right.
Yeah. It's,
I love framing it that way.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense too. And it's also encouraging for me in much the same way that I think that Luke is encouraged, that he began to see this new world forming before him. And he had, he had these steps that he was able to take with people who were able to guide him.
Right.
And I think that's probably one thing that I really wanted to stress here. You've taken your first step into a much larger world. Obi-Wan was right there with him. Obi-Wan was right there with him. And he had, even though they didn't have much time together, it was obviously a very significant time that they spent together. And then as you keep going in Luke's journey, he moves from Obi-Wan to Yoda, and he really begins to take a very deep dive into facing his own potential for darkness, especially in the cave scene there in Empire. And I think it's especially significant that he has these kind of, they're masters, but you could call them mentors or coaches or pastors or teachers. They're guides in a sense. And it's absolutely essential in a Christian life as well.
You call them Jedi pastors.
You could, yeah. Isn't that some other podcast?
That was a name we threw out, wasn't it?
I think
Jedi pastor podcast.
Yeah, I think so. But does it, like,
so that was a freebie if anybody wants to take it?
But does that make sense? How does that analogy make sense? Where Luke had these figures working with him, and how it is essential for especially young Christians who have taken their first steps into this much larger world. They also need somebody to kind of help show them how this world operates. What do you think?
Yeah. Otherwise, you're kind of walking in the dark. Make it your take on this, Scott. You're the newest Christian among us. What do you think about what Kevin's proposing here? The importance of a mentor, a guide along your faith journey.
Oh, I think it's very important. Help is, a lot of times I have questions where I'm trying to reconcile a passage or you know, a certain verse, and it just, I'm trying to reconcile it so I can reach out to, you know, yourself, Jared, or Decker, or somebody else at the church, and having someone like that to lean on to help you on your journey, I think is very important. I think you can look at people, the prequel trilogy and Anakin's journey, where he starts getting bad advice on his journey as he's going through. He's getting he's getting some bad advice and the wrong advice there that leads him to a place where, you know, he wasn't, I'm going to put quotation markers, destined to go. He was supposed to bring balance to the force. He was supposed to be the chosen one, but he chose the dark side, you know, where, you know, because I think it's pretty clear in the movies that the leadership in the Jedi Council wasn't fully believing in him. And so that other voices could come in. And I think having somebody in on that side of it, somebody in the church, if you will, who believes in you, is very important.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think about an experience I had in the church growing up when I was a kid. I was part of a congregation in Oklahoma, and we did this big summer campaign, an evangelistic campaign. And now I'm going to say some difficult, some negative things about it, but I also want to emphasize, I don't know if I would be in ministry if it hadn't been for this experience. Mm-hmm. Having gone through this, gone door knocking with, you know, these little 3-person teams from our church all summer long. Like, that was my summer. It was not baseball and swimming pools. It was preaching the gospel to the lost. And, you know, I was grateful as an 8-year-old to be along on this, and I was all in. I mean, I got real excited about it. Once you see, like, people really getting into the Bible for the first time in their lives and being willing to talk about spiritual matters, and you realize, like, they were just around the corner from us in our own neighborhoods. And for me, I saw the beauty of the gospel, what it was to, of course, Jesus dies on the cross, is buried, and is raised again. And I, you know, we're showing these little charts to people, and we see this is what we do in baptism. We confess our sin, we repent, start living a new life. You're baptized, buried with Christ, and raised in newness of life. And I was like, hey, it kind of works out just right. Death, burial, and resurrection for Jesus and for us. It's almost like there's a grand plan here. And so all these things did get me into ministry eventually. Our church, in our town of, 15,000? We baptized over 100 individuals from our small town. Over 100 people were dunked in the name of Jesus that summer. And I say dunked because my question is, how many of them were baptized? How many got wet versus how many truly started their walk with Christ? Yeah. And it's hard for me to know 20 years later. One of the great lessons our church learned was we weren't doing a good enough job at the follow-up. We were doing a good job at getting people into the water, but not a good enough job with what you're describing, Kevin, which is pastoring people, mentoring them, helping them walk the walk of faith, not just have that spark of initial faith. We ended up with, 5 out of the 108 that we baptized that summer who were still Christians 5 years later at that congregation. Now, I'd like to think that there's a lot of grace that God can have on a church that's gone through something like that. Maybe those people have gone on to years later, decades later even. Maybe they've been at other churches. Maybe we planted the seed and other people have watered. I hold out hope for that. What I do know is that the church was strengthened because of it, because we learned how to do it and how not to do it. Because it wasn't just about getting people wet. It wasn't just about dunking them in water in the name of Jesus. It was about leading them to live like Jesus. Now, that leads me to a follow-up question I've got on all this. We're talking about what it is to start your Christian journey. We're talking about the importance of Christian mentors in your life, the importance of having somebody come alongside you and guide you in the faith, help you learn how to persevere when Satan strikes. You know, we had a new Christian at our church just last year who very shortly after his baptism was hit with some serious crises. And I said to him, brother, this was to be expected. As soon as you pledge your life to Christ, you better be expecting some trouble because Satan wants to knock you off that path. But I wonder, let's say that you get off to the wrong start. whether you were reached in the name of Jesus in the wrong way, like we were doing that summer. We just... maybe we're scaring people into it with fear of hell more than we were with coming to love the God who has saved you. Maybe you get started off on the wrong foot. Maybe you have a false start in your Christian faith. Is it possible, do you think, to restart your Christian journey if you've gotten off on the wrong foot with God or with the church? You ever seen any success stories of people who had to try again?
Yeah, I'm I'm reminded of a family down here that, I mean, they had some church connection. One of the parents of this couple had been a pretty long time active participant in our congregation. But this couple, they'd come occasionally. They wouldn't talk very much. They probably considered themselves Christians.
Yeah.
But it would have been difficult for them to pinpoint maybe why they were, or would have been difficult for someone on staff to say, oh yeah, I know them. Here's information about them. Here's, you know, like, I'm in relationship with them, stuff like that. All the signs, you know, would have been difficult to point to, sure, indicating that they were actually Christians. And this parent passed away. And that false start of sort of having some church connection where they might have considered themselves Christians, their sense of security, their sense of kind of like their, maybe their access to God in a strange, yeah, way. Like if you have a loved one who's especially close, and they're beloved, and something terrible happens to them, I wonder if a lot of folks who might not think of themselves as particularly religious, but this loved one is particularly religious, I wonder if that somehow, like, that somehow jars them into thinking, you know, that might happen to me. And they seemed to have some hope for something greater than just this life. Maybe I should look into that. Yeah. Maybe I should look into that. And go ahead.
Starting to become aware of spiritual reality.
Right.
I was saying, like, some people can be blind to the fact that there is a spiritual realm, and whether you subscribe to the Christian belief and what that spiritual realm looks like and how it functions. You know, there are a lot of people who go through life believing, well, this life is all there is, what I can see, smell, touch, taste. This is life. And sometimes it does take a crisis. Sometimes it does take a tragedy to wake you up to a spiritual reality. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. 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 I didn't say it as elegantly as you did. But yeah.
Well, I've got slower internet this week, so I think I was behind you on a sentence or so. Didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Scott, what do you think? Does that make sense to you? Have you kind of seen something similar in your experience?
I would say I've kind of gone through some of these things. I grew up in not a religious family. The only time I would go to church is my wife would bring me to church, and we go to a Catholic church, and you know, we got to know the local father, and he was an awesome man of God. He just oozed it out every pore. He was just so awesome. And a little aside is, my wife and I got married. We got married by a justice of the peace in a field up in Maine, and very hippie wedding. So this father blessed our wedding, blessed our marriage, after the fact, I used to work with him as the church was also the sponsor of our local Boy Scout troop. So I would work with him as a person who worked in the Scouts. Once he moved on, I think it may have been a combination of several things. He was moved on, and the people who come in after that couldn't get the same kind of reaction. And then around that time, my father had passed away. So that would be, you could definitely call that a what little faith I may have had at that point was definitely in crisis, you know. We kind of moved around a little bit, tried different churches and stuff. And that's when we ended up in Jared's church in Leominster, and then where we felt like we were home. And I don't know if that's what you were thinking about, but those were the people that welcomed us in like nobody else had.
Yeah.
They were the ones who were very welcoming and very, best word I can come up with is yeah. We felt like it was truly a family. Mm-hmm. And even some of the other parishioners would come up and we would all chat, and then we'd become very friendly with a lot of them and stuff. And I think having that family of environment helps keep me in this faith and keeps me going in the straight and narrow, if you will. And if I have any questions, I'm not kind of just like on my own with people I don't know or trust or anything like that. So I don't know if that's what you're going for, but that's kind of been my journey.
That's no, that to hear, Scott. Obviously, I want to hear about how great our church is. But more importantly, I hope that your story gives people hope.
Yeah.
People who might be listening to this who have not had a great first step with God or with the church, who felt like, well, am I even on the right foot? Have I even really started a spiritual journey, or have I done something that might have the veneer of spirituality, the veneer of Christianity, or is there more to this? Is there really more to this Christian life? And, you know, hopefully your story is not so different from Abraham as the late bloomer, right? Baptized as an adult. And that's beautiful. I think that gives a lot of hope. Don't you think, Kevin?
Definitely. Yeah. It's interesting too, that it basically, there's a key component here. There was a parent figure who had passed away. And that was a significant moment in the faith journey that Scott just described for us, and the faith journey of the couple that I explained earlier. I don't think it's unfair to say that something similar happens to Luke Skywalker. He doesn't show a ton of emotion when the Lars are dead.
You saying that Scott is Luke Skywalker?
This is cool. I've been trying to tell people all along.
He's our OTOG, as we've referred to him several times on the podcast. But okay, so like the only family that Luke has known, they die, and then suddenly this mentor figure that has shown Luke an entirely new world that Luke has. I mean, he's known Ben Kenobi, like he knows who he is prior to the beginning of A New Hope, because when he sees the hologram of Leia and she says, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi," she's like, "I wonder if that's Ben Kenobi." So like, he knows who this guy is, but
I like to think he knows of him more than
that's
he
fair.
Knows him.
Yeah, and that's fair. Yeah, he might know of him, but they hit it off immediately, and like some of us, and maybe if folks are kind enough to listen, have maybe you've had some friend where you got to know them and you hit it off immediately, and you suddenly feel like you're lifelong friends. Or there's an older person either in a church or like some other social setting where you find yourself where it's like, oh, this is a dynamic that I have never really experienced, but always kind of longed for. I just maybe couldn't verbalize it. I think that's what Luke finds himself in. And then he has this, I mean, yeah. He has the death of a spiritual parent, basically, in Obi-Wan Kenobi. And so that's it's fascinating that, you know, again, Scott's experience and this couple's that I've described and in Luke's, there is some kind of tragedy that undercuts some aspect, some component of our foundation, something that we thought was solid, something that was there, that we could hang on to, whatever. And that tends, that in a lot of ways can kind of jar us and it maybe remove some blinders in some way, to where maybe we are more willing to look for something especially meaningful. This is not nearly as significant as losing a parent. But I distinctly remember I had one plan for where I was going to go for college. It was the safe option. It was in town where I grew up. And it was going to be you know, I was going to room with my, you know, best friend from youth group at the time. And then that the day that my very first girlfriend broke up with me, I got home.
Oh, no.
I was distraught and had a, got a phone call from a recruiter from a Christian college out of state. And I started talking to this person, and I had never once considered the school, but because I had had a tragedy, and let me put that in quotes, okay? Let me put that in quotes, a tragedy.
Right.
You know, yeah. High school, first girlfriend, okay?
That's a teenage tragedy.
That's exactly what it was. It was a teenage
tragedy. Teenagers at home, he knows it's, all about it.
It still hurt. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it was a great blessing. But at the time, yeah, it still hurt. So that happened. And then I talked to this recruiter at this school that was 12 hours away, like a 12-hour drive away from home. Like, yikes.
Wow.
Then the next day, I got to talk to another recruiter from the school that I actually ended up attending for college. And one of the reasons why I was so willing to consider something new and different and to be willing to jump into something new and different was because what I had known, that whatever security I had had in that relatively short relationship, but still significant because it was my first dating relationship, all that security was gone. And suddenly I was, it's like, well, yeah, okay. Maybe there's something else out there, and maybe I can find something meaningful somewhere else. So,
yeah, I think you're getting onto something big here, which is that a lot of people can have a false sense of security that can stand in the way of wanting to pursue deeper questions about life and spirituality.
Yeah.
We find these coming up in scripture, even. You know, I love the story of Jesus and blind Bartimaeus, where he says, throw off whatever entangles you, throw off your cloak. And then he follows Jesus when he throws off what's holding him back. Fortunately, in America, it's such a prosperous country that prosperity can actually be an obstacle to people's faith. If you have anything that you could possibly need or want for your comfort and security with free two-day shipping, then why do you need to pursue these bigger questions, right?
Yeah.
And so it's sometimes it takes a kick in the seat of the pants to realize that maybe the comfort that I had isn't as comfortable as I thought it was. Or maybe this is just me being pessimistic because I just got out of a week-long class on Ecclesiastes, which says vanity is vanity. Everything is worthless, says the sage. But I do think we're onto something here. Do you think I'm onto something here, Scott, that sometimes as Americans we can have we can be too comfortable to care if God is a part of our lives?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that we're not that, like you said, you can go out and get retail therapy. You don't need to talk to God. You can go out, you know, and a lot of people who do that, instead of sharing their feelings or searching for an answer, they go out and they'll buy something. They'll buy a new car or something. You know, I've known plenty of people who are of that ilk. And, I don't think it's wrong to say that. I mean, in general, I think we're pretty soft. So,
yeah, I think that's a road to nowhere. The most peaceful people I've ever known, the people who are most content with life and seem to be tapped into a spiritual realm, whether they were Christians or not, people who seem to know that there's more to this life than instant gratification, are the people who have the least in terms of possessions that I've ever known. I think about this couple in that same town in Oklahoma who they lived in just like a one bedroom apartment, this elderly couple, and they were the most giving people I've ever known. They both had horrible illnesses and were in a lot of pain all the time, but they exuded joy. Their generosity was contagious. They made you want to be simpler, kinder people. And so on the one hand, hopefully in this conversation, if you're listening to this, I don't think the the takeaway is, well, I really hope I have a tragedy sometime soon so that I can start asking some spiritual questions. But to not be afraid to ask the difficult questions. Mm-hmm. Scott?
I'll just say, you could look at this from a non-tragedy perspective of, if you look at the Mandalorian fundamentally changed who he was once he had to care for another.
Sure.
Yeah. He was now in charge of another being and getting them where he needs to go and shepherd might be the wrong answer, but making sure he gets to where he needs to be. So he kind of changed, maybe not at his core who he was, but he changed a lot of his outlook, and he learned a lot about what he believed along the way, about what, you know, what the armorer had taught him in versus what Bo-Katan would talk about. And, you know, so he had a bit of a journey there, and it was helping somebody. So it's not always, you have to, you know, look at a dark event that could kick you in the shorts. Maybe it's just a little more responsibility.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I know some people who have started saying like, oh, I guess we need to get back in church after they had children and realized, like, are we just going to raise our kids in a religion of vanity where we just, the religion is instant gratification and just taking care of ourselves and no one else and not belonging to a larger community. And so I know plenty of Christians who have fallen away from faith, fallen out of church in their college years and have come back as young adults. That's a good example. I'm trying to think of some other times when a person might start asking these difficult questions about spirituality and faith in order to start taking that first step.
In the Star Wars universe, you see, to go along with, sorry to interrupt, Jared, to go along with what Scott was saying, in Star Wars universe, you see a similar kind of relationship between Mando and Grogu with Kanan and Ezra from Rebels. We have basically, you have two guys who need each other to grow, to be transformed into who they need to become. And okay, so there are tragedies in their pasts as well, but they basically learn to adopt a family that is not their flesh and blood family, and in the process of doing so, they develop this kind of mentor mentee bond that leads them both into greater degrees of transformation. It's very much like partnering with, you know, an older, more mature, you know, quote unquote brother or sister in Christian faith when you're younger and in your faith. Yeah,
that's right. And finding that family is so important. It's so important in your spiritual journey. Can we talk about the importance of church, the broader Christian family, in terms of bringing you along in your faith? I just mentioned this past Sunday about how I was preaching from Colossians 2 about being rooted and established in love, and then going somewhere beyond just having some Christian stability, right? Doing something productive. So that very same text says, so walk in him. It talks about bearing fruit and being productive, not just being anchored in your faith, knowing what you believe, but then doing something for the kingdom. And I talked about how I came to a point in my life, mentioned this on our doubt episode, where I just felt absolutely rocked to my core after my mother passed away 5 years ago. And here I was stepping into this new pastoral role, mentoring and shepherding and preaching for a new congregation in a new part of the country. And I felt totally lost. And what I said to the church was, you all supported me through that. I wasn't as public about the crisis I was going through at the time because I wanted to appear strong, but I leaned on you. There was this elderly woman. She's passed away now, named Dot. What a great old lady name, Dot, who every day of her life was in immense pain. Her kidneys were failing. She was on dialysis. And yet she was so incredibly joyful. And I leaned on her example in how to be joyful through suffering. I leaned on the example of one of our elders who had Parkinson's, who was determined to do as much as he could for the kingdom, not just in spite of his limitations, but through his limitations, to use that as part of his story to help shape others who are suffering in their own ways. And I think this, my own personal example, goes to show the importance of having a multi-generational diverse church, not just the church of people who are just like you. Now, Scott, our church is a mess, but it's diverse, both racially and age-wise, and even in some of our beliefs, that not everybody believes the same things, and yet we navigate these personality quirks to the glory of God. Can you speak to the importance of having a church of people who are not always just like you?
I think that's extremely important. Dot was an inspiration. She was. She was always the first one there. You know, and well, from maybe because I'm always the last one there, but her and her husband were just pillars, and you know, we couldn't be more different. And there's a lot of people in the church who you know I talk to and stuff, and I don't know, outside of our faith, we're probably pretty different people and stuff. But it's, you know, it's what brings us together, and it kind of, you know, helps you, keeps it from being an echo chamber, I think, you know, which, yeah, I think are very bad places to be. You know, I don't need to hear more about someone just like me. You know, I grow more when I hear about other people, you know, even, you know, hearing about, you know, Jared growing up in Oklahoma and talking to you, Kevin, about, you know, just, you know, your experience in Texas, just even that little bit is good. Mm-hmm. And we have a really diverse spread of people and who are just awesome. I can't say enough good things about them. So.
Yeah. I think the important thing here is to be gathered into a community of faith that God establishes rather than just a community of faith that we for ourselves, people who are like us, and we can gravitate to people who are like us, who share our beliefs. One of the things I appreciate about our church, and we don't wear our politics on our sleeves, but I'm fairly certain our church is about 50-50 Democrat and Republican, and I value that, and I cherish that, because we hold one another accountable, and sometimes I get pulled aside for saying something that sounds too conservative, sometimes I get pulled aside for saying something that sounds too liberal, and I say, well, then I think we're doing the right thing here. I'm going to keep preaching the politics of Jesus that transcends earthly politics, but we've got to hold each other accountable. We've got to have people who will say, I think you've crossed the line here, and because I value the witness of Christ, we need to come back to the center. I can think about a mentor, a friend of mine, Carrie Verner, who we'll have on the podcast at one point. One morning, he and I were out to breakfast in Memphis. We're going to have grad school learning about the Bible, you know, all day. And I said something. I hadn't had my coffee yet. If that's an excuse, it's not. I said something not just offensive, but sinful at breakfast, degrading another person. They'd gotten my order wrong at Panera Bread in Memphis. And under my breath, I said something hateful. And Carrie confronted me with the vigor of an Old Testament prophet to say, you're better than that. And yeah. I didn't talk to him the rest of the day. I was furious. I was embarrassed. And to this day, with tears in my eyes, I recount that story as one of the most important moments in our friendship, and more importantly, in my faith walk, to realize I was allowing this sin to fester, and I was keeping it around and sweeping under the rug. But I had a friend who said, you're better than that. And you've got to have a Christian community that can, a mentor even, whether it's a Yoda who says, you know, your fear is going to be your path to the dark side. Somebody who can call you to the carpet to say, hey, this isn't pleasant, but you need to hear this in order to progress in your journey. Kevin, have you ever had a mentor in your life who's come alongside you to steer you back on the path?
I can't think of a particular mentor figure to do that. Oh, that is incorrect. I just thought of one. Yeah,
here we go.
This was absolutely significant too. Yeah, this was a huge deal. I was in the tail end of my first master's degree. Private school, I'm just going to say, private school is an expensive place to find yourself. Okay. So, I'm still paying for that. But I was nearing the end of my master's of science in education. emphasizing high school history and social studies, and I knew at this point in the program that I was going to get my MDiv and eventually get a PhD in biblical studies. So I wasn't trying to give a half-hearted effort, but it was happening. And I got called into the dean's office, or the chair of the history department's office at Harding. And he asked me, "Hey, are you going to turn in your portfolio for this, student teaching class?" And I said, "What portfolio?" We talked about it. It was in the syllabus. And I said, "Well, if I don't do it, what's my grade in the class?" Because it was due like previous week, and it's near the end of the semester, and I was wiped out. And he said, "Well, right now you've got an A, you'll drop down to a C." I said, "Okay." That was it. Okay. And then I proceeded to ask him about this class that I thought I needed to take with him over the summer as a summer course. And the idea was the way that class was particularly lined up, he had to read 15 books over the summer, 5 books on 3 different but related subjects. That's a pretty heavy reading load. I had just demonstrated that I was not good at finishing work. And I was asking him about this class, and he said, "Kevin, look, I'm sorry to tell you, but I am unwilling to commit to working with you when you have shown that you are unwilling to finish work to which you've committed."
Ooh, and that hurts.
That's
like,
stung.
I'm not mad, but I'm disappointed.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was. And that was the spring semester before I enrolled in my Master's of Divinity. And every time I left class there, you know, in Memphis, working on my MDiv, every time I left class and thought, "I've seen a break, I don't want to do this, I don't want to study anymore," I heard him say, "I am unwilling to commit to working with you." And that was my mantra for the whole year. I busted my tail in the library whenever I wasn't eating or in class or, you know, in my apartment for the night. I was in the library studying, working hard. That was the loving but deserved swift kick in the seat of the pants that I needed. Yeah. In a sense, he needed to give me that death blow. I needed to die.
Sure.
I needed to die so I could be reborn.
That's right.
And that's the kind of thing I think we could say that we see happen to Luke. Luke needed to leave that old life on Tatooine. And Jared, I think this was something that you had in your notes. Tatooine was safe. It was comfortable. Yeah, Luke wasn't. He wasn't. I don't think he was hanging out at Mos Eisley all the time. He knew where it was, but I mean, he wasn't there all the time. But it was safe and it was comfortable, but it wasn't where he needed to be. He needed to leave that old life, and he needed to join, basically, to experience a new life in the Force. And he also needed these people to walk with him, not just guys like Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda, but also Leia and Han,
yeah,
and Chewbacca. There was a whole team. There was a whole family around him, a literal family, as he would come to find out, Leia, but there was a whole family behind him as he began to step into this much larger world. And you can't explore a new world with just one step. You have to keep moving.
That's right. I think your story really... Go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say, I think sometimes, you know, the people who are alongside you, not the ones who are leading the teaching of it, but your peers who expect a certain, you know, are expecting you to do certain things that fall onto you are just as important as the ones who are teaching you what you need to do. What I've done a lot of times at work is people are giving me more responsibilities. And I've been in positions before where I've slacked off on that And they say, okay, well, don't worry about it. You don't have to do that anymore. And then, you know, I reflect on it. And I'm like, you know, I've let myself down because of these things. So whenever I'm getting these things, I always strive to do the best job that I can because I don't want to let myself down on top of letting other people down.
And I think this really, both of those stories get us to this idea of giving a bare minimum effort. And unfortunately, I'm teaching a church history class right now, so maybe this is because of my own current studies. It's often, I think about Martin Luther's story of going and finding this, finding that there was a man who wasn't at worship on Sunday when he was preaching. And as soon as worship was done, he goes out into the streets and finds this very same member visibly drunk, walking the streets in the middle of the morning on a Sunday. And he confronts the man and says, "You were drunk out here in the street instead of coming to worship?" And the man pulls out an indulgence from his pocket, a certificate showing he'd had his sins forgiven and it was all cool with God. And this drove Martin Luther to become Martin Luther, right? He wanted to dismantle this this notion of indulgences. But the point was, this guy thought, like, hey, I'm giving the bare minimum effort. As long as I just pay the price and get my sins forgiven, I'm good with God. Much like Kevin, of course, realizing, like, I could just not turn in the paper and make a C, and that's fine. Or, you know, letting yourself down in terms of not getting the responsibilities done. The amazing thing, of course, is there, unfortunately, a lot of Christians who will take that first step, whether it's confessing the need for Christ in your life or even making the step to be immersed in the waters of baptism, to make this pledge that I'm going to follow Jesus. And a lot of times it ends there. Hopefully tonight can inspire you to be thinking about what it is, what God might be calling you to beyond that first step initially on your journey of faith, and the kind of possibilities that might await you, whether that means being immersed not just in baptism, but in a church family. It only takes a Google search. It only takes a Google search or a text message to a Christian in your life to say, help me find a church. And there's ones too. Maybe it looks different than that. You know, I think about the people in church who I get nervous thinking about asking them to step up into a new ministry role, knowing it's going to be good for them, but knowing they don't want me to ask them to step up and serve in this particular key area. Kevin, can we talk about, as we wind down the episode here, how important it is? What kind of texts, what kind of advice would you give to somebody thinking about going beyond that first step in the faith?
Yeah. It's no surprise, or it shouldn't surprise us that throughout the letters of the Apostle Paul, he routinely refers to his Christian family as brothers and sisters. And so you can read some of his texts, like the letter that he wrote to Christians in a Greek city called Philippi, a letter to the Philippians. That's a great text that that emphasizes the togetherness that's essential for growing and being transformed more and more like Jesus. Another text that is especially significant for me is found in Romans, again from the Apostle Paul, his massive tome to the Romans. Romans chapter 6, verses 1 through 11. It's a beautiful passage that describes, basically spells out the analogy of how Jesus, when Jesus was crucified and was buried and then was raised to new life, how the Christian participates in that. Essentially, the Christian imitates that or reenacts that. They participate in that death, burial, and resurrection when the Christian is baptized, when they're immersed under the water and they come back up. That, it's symbolic, but you experience a type of death and a type of new birth. The key to remembering all of that is the new birth is not the end goal. Right. A new birth is not the end goal. Think about it like, use the analogy, since we're talking about birth, think about it like a baby. under ideal circumstances or under typical circumstances, this baby that is born will grow and mature. They will know, they, you know, 2-3 years down the road, they won't just cry when they want something. They'll learn to ask for it. They'll learn to have a degree of self-sufficiency because they have grown, because they've transformed. And ideally that will continue to where they become productive in all kinds of ways as they grow and mature spiritually. That is the same thing.
A bunch of babies walking around, never becoming adults.
Right, right. Yeah. And like that would absolutely wreck a church to have a bunch of spiritual babies in positions of leadership or heads of ministries or things like that. That's absolutely not what God wants of us. He loves us and accepts us as we are. He very lovingly refuses to leave us the way we are because there's growth and transformation that we all need to experience.
Definitely. Yeah. One of the texts that I would want to recommend for somebody thinking about how there's more to the Christian journey than just the first step would be 2 Corinthians 5. It's one of my favorite chapters in the Bible where it's all about God reconciling us to him and us to one another through him. And in the middle of all of this, Paul says that though we once regarded Christ in a worldly point of view, you know, you think about all the different perspectives people might have on Jesus from an earthly point of view, he says, we no longer do so, we being Christians. And in the same way, he says, we should not regard anyone from a worldly point of view, because if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. So we're thinking about having a change of perspective that happens. And that's something that doesn't happen overnight. You don't come up out of the waters of baptism with a totally new perspective. And every person you meet, now you look at them like Jesus would look at them. Wouldn't that be nice? But instead, it's this gradual process. And I love this term that he uses in 2 Corinthians 5, that if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The new has come. We're thinking about putting that old person behind us and becoming a new person, being transformed by God. And certainly that's been the case, you know, with you, Scott. Your Christian journey has shown, like, you're not the same person you were when I first met you. You're not the same person you were when you first came out of the waters of baptism. You're becoming a new creation. I think this is certainly what all this is about, don't you think?
Absolutely. And you know, it's, you know, I've been enjoying the journey and you know, and the growth. And sometimes it's not always fun, but, you know, it's what you have to get through. You know, you have to learn and grow. And self-discovery is sometimes wonderful and sometimes painful. So
it's not always a direct path forward either. Sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back.
Yes. Yes. It's just learning that kind of stuff too, that not, you know, as you put it, just getting dunked doesn't solve your problems. It's fix anything with you. It's, you know, you got to put in your own work and you have to meet everybody, you know, on the way. So.
Yeah. And let the Spirit do his work in you as well. Well, this has been a really fruitful conversation. Hopefully it's been of help to you listeners. I've been really encouraged by it for sure. It's also getting late over here on the East Coast, so we're going to wind this sucker down. In terms of what you might want to look at in the Star Wars universe, personally, this has got me wanting to rewatch A New Hope, thinking about Luke taking his first step into a larger world. The question is, do I watch the special edition or do I track down that old VHS, the de-specialized? So I think I've got that on a
I've got the VHS copy of the original trilogy.
Scott would have it, yeah.
Scott would. I've got to admit, Scott, I don't have a working VHS player in my house.
I was going to say, that's the biggest problem, is finding a VCR that works.
I do have a working Nintendo 64 on which I've been playing Shadows of the Empire.
Priorities, man.
That's been fun. That's right. Well, in terms of things you might want to look into more in the Star Wars galaxy in tandem with this episode, I highly recommend looking at the prologue to Jason Fry's novelization of The Last Jedi, as I mentioned. If you just want that prologue and not the whole book, you know, you can get it for free with the Amazon Kindle. Send a sample. You can read that prologue for free. You can check it out on Google Books. That's how I do a lot of my research for grad school. You know what I'm talking about, Kevin. Can't get the book in the library. Look at those Google Books previews. It's on there as well. Of course, you can always find it on utini.com, the site that I write for and podcast for outside of this. Personally, we just did a massive roundtable crossover event with Shadows of the Empire. We did we covered the comic, covered the book, talked about the video game, we talked about the action figures. That's a lot of fun. Would encourage people to check that out. Kevin, what have you had going on? Tell us about Faith in the Fold.
I'll get to that in just a second. One thing I wanted to mention is if you're interested in seeing a really good story of transformation where someone really comes into their own and I think gains a pretty significant degree of spiritual maturity in the Star Wars universe, it is worth starting with the Clone Wars movie and then watching all the seasons of the Clone Wars and paying a special attention to Ahsoka Tano. Because she starts off as a child and then grows into, by the end of season seven, she's a young adult, teenager, like somewhere kind of in that range, right?
Yeah. Yeah, hers is certainly a story of not always a linear progression.
It's not. No, it's not. And yeah, admittedly, you know, this first season or so of Clone Wars TV show is a little slow, but otherwise. But thank you for asking about Faith in the Folds. At the time of our recording tonight, I had an interview earlier today asking a friend of mine who recently wrote his dissertation on the Book of Revelation. And I was asking him about how are some ways that we can read the Book of Revelation responsibly. And that was a fun conversation with my friend Garrett Best, a buddy of mine who's a minister in Memphis, Tennessee. And
don't have a clue what to do with Revelation.
You are not alone, my friend. There are a lot of folks who find themselves. So I asked him about what sort of preconceptions do people in the pews bring. I asked him about the mark of the beast. He's got a pretty good discussion about that. I asked him, is there anything relevant for us in the Book of Revelation today? And he had a lot of really good stuff to say about that. A lot of folks I'll let you listen to the episode. I won't tease you anymore with it.
Cool. Yeah, I will. Excellent. Well, can't wait to listen to that. It sounds awesome. Gotta finish my final on Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job next week, and then I'll listen to it. Yeah, before I get into that other difficult book of the Bible.
Yeah.
But yeah. You can, of course, get into whatever book of the Bible you want. I would recommend, if you're just thinking about starting off in your journey, if you're wondering, like, maybe I will start giving more attention to what God is doing in the world and what he might be calling me to do in my life, then I recommend starting with one of the Gospels. Personally, probably would recommend Mark or John in terms of coming to faith for the first time or restarting your journey of faith. That would be a good place to start. To get in touch with us and ask us some of these tough questions. You got some big obstacles in your journey of faith. Hey, you can get in touch with us on Instagram, hyperspace_theology. You can email us, hyperspacetheology@gmail.com. And we would love to dialogue with you. No matter how difficult it gets, we'll stick it in there with you and have it out. And if it gets especially difficult, I'll just forward those emails to Kevin. Well, everybody, this has been a lot of fun. It's been fun doing the show tonight. God bless. And,
bye.